While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal, I did an awful, awful lot that was wrong.
He said, "Hey, ain't you Jesse Harris?" And I couldn't deny that. I said, "Yeah."
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approved this message.
You know, the job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I said, "Well, I got a good job in Washington." He said, "What you doing up there?" I said, "Well, I got a job playing saxophone in a topless bar."
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
He said, "Well, that sure relieves my mind, because some fool told me you got elected to the United States Senate." And I knew that couldn't be so.
Any further discussion or debate?
From our legislative studios in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Time again to review the week in North Carolina politics. Topics we're chatting about today include the latest in a water contamination story out of Pittsburgh, a lawsuit that's dealing with whether or not solitary confinement violates the state constitution, and also a seemingly rare moment of togetherness and bipartisanship on Capitol Hill. For the discussion of this week's news, or at least some of this week's news, are Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Hey there.
Hey,
guys. A moment of wide bipartisan support on Capitol Hill Wednesday, where two-thirds of U.S. House Republicans joined Democrats in a symbolic resolution condemning the president's decision to remove U.S. troops from northern Syria. North Carolina's congressional delegation was divided on this resolution. Six Republicans voted for it, two, Mark Meadows and newly elected Greg Murphy, against, and two, abstained. All three Democrats were unsurprisingly in favor. Becky, where do you side amid this division?
I think this is something that needs to be taken very seriously. I really side on the side of caution, of proceeding very carefully. Getting a lot of other people expert opinion on this. It's scary times. It's such a volatile situation in the Middle East with this. We have supported these efforts, these anti-terrorism efforts in these countries for a number of years. I just think you have to proceed so carefully. I don't know what the answer is. If I knew what the answer was, I would not be sitting here doing this. I'd be in the Middle East making peace. But I think with this, I mean, you just have to proceed so carefully and thoughtfully.
Yes, I obviously agree. Oh, do you want to follow up? I'm sorry.
With that answer, being careful, being methodical, and the fact that it's kind of all unraveled, best we can understand as laypersons here, between a phone call between President Erdogan and President Trump, does the nature with which this has moved concern you? I mean, it hasn't been methodical or careful.
That's true. That's a good point. Yes. It's not the way in which it's done that is the most concerning to me. It's where we get the decisions that are made along the process. And I think, you know, if it's through a phone call, if it's through conferences, I mean, I don't know that there's a right way and a wrong way. This is unconventional. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the wrong way to go about it.
How would you have voted if you were in the U.S. House?
I probably would have voted to go along with the resolution. But here's the thing with this, too. As you mentioned in the introduction, this really is a non-binding kind of agreement. It's just
a symbolic
vote. And so I think that a lot of this is to, for these members of Congress, it's to go on the record as to where they stand on this. How they vote is not going to affect necessarily which way these discussions go or what the ultimate resolution of this is.
Rob, I know you would have voted for this were you a U.S. House member on the floor yesterday. But these divisions, anything more than this resolution, anything more than symbolism?
Well, I mean, I think it's symbolic of the fact that President Trump is losing his base. I mean, I think it's clear that the Republican Party has stuck with him through thick and thin. It's getting thinner or thicker or something. I mean, he's losing his way. His poll numbers are dramatically down. I think as that proceeds, there's going to be less loyalty from members of his own party. I mean, I certainly agree with Becky that this is a kind of issue that one must approach with great care and methodical analysis. And obviously, President Trump is the antithesis of that. He is shooting from the hip, sometimes literally, and causing great discord both here in the country and internationally. And I'm not surprised. I was surprised that two Republicans actually voted with him. Although I suppose Meadows. The other disappointing fact was that Dan Bishop, who's a new member of Congress, gets a first big vote, and then what? He can't find his way to the Capitol or something to vote. I thought that was very surprising that the Ninth District's been without representation for so long, and now maybe they're still without representation.
He has not literally started shooting from the hip yet.
I guess not.
I think we need to be careful on this, too, as we talk about, you know, a thoughtful, considerate, very well thought through solutions to these. I think we need to really be careful that this doesn't become another political argument, another bipartisan standoff. And the fact that you've got members of both parties voting different ways on this and having conversations, I think is we want to see more of that rather than less. And I don't think this should become a discussion of, well, you're either with Trump or you're against Trump or this is all about Trumpism. You know, this is about the national security of our country. And, of course, the president leading this effort, there is some degree of that. But I think that there's a danger of making this a political argument. I've even heard in some of these discussions tying the impeachment efforts along with this. And I think that's the wrong way to go. I think that the national security issue needs to be considered, again, thoughtfully and carefully.
I think very clearly in this moment, it's moved beyond a political divide. I mean, when you've got
yes.
Nancy Pelosi and Lindsey Graham condemning the president on what has played out here in the Middle East, that speaks considerably in the moment that we're in, the larger moment.
Right. And I think, you know, I'd like to see more discussions and more decisions move along those lines so that you put the partisan differences aside and move forward. Again, thoughtfully and really considering the facts and the dangers and everything else that's at stake with this.
I mean, I think that's what's happening here. I think that increasingly we're seeing that all Americans are coming to realize the danger of that Trump poses to the country and to the world, and are coming together. Even Republicans who want to be with him and are still sticking with him on a lot of very specific issues are starting to have grave doubts about his leadership. And there's no way that can't be a political issue, or a debate like this can't be political. Anytime you have a vote in Congress, it's inherently political. But it's clear we have a pretty good agreement amongst a large majority right now.
Four inmates are challenging the use of solitary confinement, alleging in a lawsuit filed this week that the practice ultimately amounts to cruel and unusual punishment. The ACLU and North Carolina Prisoner Legal Services are representing four clients. Solitary confinement, often referred to in this state as restrictive housing, generally consists of 22 hours a day in a very small cell with virtually no human interaction. In recent years, a number of other states have implemented changes to the solitary confinement practice. How, if at all, should the use of solitary confinement be reformed in North Carolina prisons?
You know, there's a lot of issues these days where I think we find ourselves looking back a few years and saying, what in the heck were we thinking? What in the heck were we thinking when we didn't have, when we treated lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people the way we treated them, when we had the overt racism in our society? And to me, this is another example of what the heck were we thinking? How did anybody ever think that this was a suitable way to treat another human being, regardless of the offenses that they've committed? I think it needs to end, solitary confinement, except for extraordinary circumstances in which perhaps you're literally addressing immediate emergency safety issues, needs to end. It's clearly cruel and unusual punishment. It's counterproductive. And, I mean, when you read some of the facts of these cases that the ACLU has brought up, the desperate psychological pain that's inflicted on individuals who are in these circumstances, it just seems to me it's another area where North Carolina is just going to have to catch up with the rest of the civilized world.
Well, I think that, you know, a couple points here. One, I think that this is a tool that has been used. I think that the increase, and you see this from the data that's out there, that the increase in the use of solitary confinement as far as the number of hours, the number of days, the length that some of these prisoners are held in that, and then also the number of prisoners who are confined to this solitary confinement has increased dramatically over the years. Really at a point now where I think that there is certainly something that needs to be done about about this. Now, as Rob mentioned, you know, there are extenuating circumstances or in some needs of an immediate safety issue for the prisoner, also for the people who work in the prison. I mean, we've seen that here in North Carolina, these terrible situations where some of the prisoners have killed the prison guards. You know, there needs to be some sort of safety release, if you will, you know, almost like a timeout kind of thing in these circumstances that warrant that. I think there needs to be consistency with that. I think there needs to be a process. There needs to be some sort of determination in that. Now, often this may happen in a very volatile situation where that decision has to be made right away. I think that there's a use for that in those circumstances, but I think that this has gone beyond that. I think it's something that we really need to look at. And it brings to me really the issue of mental health and how we treat mental health, not only in our prisons, but, you know, we see so many times, and there have been lots of studies of looking at people that are sent to prison and people that are committing crimes, people that are convicted of crimes, and mental health issues that are surrounding that. So I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunities in this discussion of things to talk about, problems to be solved, challenges that we're facing, and ways to go about that. The other thing I thought was interesting is this case is a class action lawsuit against the state of North Carolina. Just a little bit of research before we were going to discuss this topic. There have been cases that have been brought to the United States or the United States Supreme Court on numerous occasions about is solitary confinement a violation of the federal constitution, and the Supreme Court has kicked it back every time. They have not ruled on that, to my knowledge. I mean, through 2018, I think just, you know, kind of a cursory check was the last that I had. So it does fall to the states to look at that, which then goes to the interpretation of each state constitution. So it also brings up some legal issues that way, and maybe looking at our state constitutions, certainly in North Carolina, which we've had constitutional amendments before, to maybe take a look at that. Not only how does it read now, is there a problem that needs to be solved that would warrant changes to our Constitution? I don't know the answers to those, but I think that they're interesting issues that are raised with this discussion.
Just one other point, I agree with a lot of what Becky said, is that it's increasingly clear from some of the reporting our journalists at NC Policy Watch have done that a lot of this is being driven by the fact that our prisons are incredibly understaffed. We're having desperate trouble even finding prison guards. We're literally shuttering prisons or parts of prisons because we don't have the staff to run them. And as a practical matter, solitary confinement in some circumstances is just being used because we don't have enough people to watch everybody. So it appears anyway, billeting people in solitary confinement just as a cost-saving measure. And that really speaks to the fact that we are desperately underfunded, our correction system. We need to spend a lot more money if we're going to attract quality people to come and work in these very difficult circumstances. And that's another byproduct of our sustained underinvestment in public services and structures in the state.
Well, and as part of this year's budget, and actually part of one of the many budgets that has been passed that the governor has signed into law, is additional pay for correction officers, for prison guards. So we're moving in the right direction, I think, but still
just
a lot of work to be done, and raises some other really serious and challenging questions.
We've learned more about a water contamination issue in Pittsburgh. We have known for weeks that the water there was tainted drinking water with the discharge of a likely carcinogen in the Cape Fear River. However, state officials had refused to provide any additional information on the source of the contamination until recently. The Department of Environmental Quality more or less relented this week and acknowledged that it came from Shamrock Environmental Corporation. This is a company out of Greensboro that handles industrial waste. Rob, you sit here week after week advocating for improved environmental practices. This, I'll call it posturing by state regulators, cannot possibly do much for your optimism that government is going to do the right thing.
Yeah, the PFAS, all these emerging contaminants, the 1,4-dioxane that are showing up in our water supply, I think this is really sort of like a very dangerous canary in the coal mine, if you will. This stuff is, we're finding out more and more of it. It's everywhere. And the federal EPA has done literally nothing about it. They're not regulating this stuff, which is almost certainly a carcinogen. State lawmakers or state regulators are way behind as well. They're overmatched and in some instances just not fully perhaps doing what they ought to be doing in this realm. It's a very serious issue, and it's going to get a lot more serious real quick, and we need to start paying a lot more attention to it.
Well, I think if you just look at the timeline of how this came out, you know, it kind of tells I made a timeline. But if you will, on August 7th, there was the sample that was taken of this water. August 21st, 2 weeks later, Greensboro learns of the release. It was not until September 27th, almost a month later, that Greensboro notified the regulators, called it a mistake by a Greensboro company. DEQ learns of it at that time, too. But by that time, the contamination had pretty much dissipated. So the initial alarm was released. But then, as of October 14th, like you mentioned, I mean, we've just learned what the name of the company was. And before that, DEQ and the city of Greensboro were kind of pointing fingers at each other, saying, well, I'm not going to tell. Well, I'm not going to tell. I'm not going to tell. So, you know, this has been, you know, a good 3 months or 2 months from October 7th to October 18th today, you know, before we really know, well, we still don't really know what happened. It was said it was an accident, but we don't know how much was released. We don't really know how it happened. We do know the name of the company, but this is just, you know, this is not the way that you should be handling these things.
I do believe that the company has said in a statement that it didn't, it was discharging something on behalf of a client. It purports to not have known that the contents of that were toxic. Now, I can't weigh in on whether or not they knew. We don't know, but that's their positioning.
Right.
Quick idealistic follow-up here. Would you be in support of having some kind of automatic reporting where, like, if DEQ gets a red flag, so to speak, they are alerted of something being illegally dumped or some toxic thing being dumped into a river that downstream is going to provide water to North Carolinians? Is that something that should just be posted 24 or 48 hours later? Let me just be clear. That's not going to happen. But I'm
well, let me ask a question. What if this had been Duke Energy? I mean, remember with the coal ash spill? The coal ash spill.
But they did report pretty quickly, did they not?
Like immediately.
Right.
You know, but here we have on August 7th, the sample was taken, and here now, you know, the mid to late part of October, we're finally learning this.
What is your contention there? Are you saying that that Duke was required to do it, and they did, that Duke was being a good steward back with coal ash?
Well, I'm
all for disclosures.
Well, I'm all for disclosure, too. It just seems to be sort of a double standard here. When DEQ feels like it's to their benefit to immediately release information, then they tend to do it. If it's not, we don't know why they didn't do this. I mean, yeah, you know, there's a lot of questions around this.
I think this is probably a bureaucratic snafu where a lot of parties probably bear some responsibility. I doubt there was any a will on anybody's part, but it points out again that this stuff is bad stuff. It's not well regulated. Indeed, the federal EPA has not even established standards for it. And I can't overestimate or overstate how much the Trump administration has just been eviscerating the federal EPA and demoralizing the employees and cutting back on every environmental regulation there is, much less empowering them to adopt new regulations. And this is the kind of thing where we need an aggressive approach from environmental regulators, or we are going to be up to our armpits in this stuff. And these kinds of chemicals aren't things that just dissipate. You know, they don't just go away. They're so often referred to as so-called forever chemicals. They build up in your body. They cause lots of health problems, it appears. Again, we got to get serious about this stuff, and that includes the feds, the states, and the city level.
And I think hold everybody to the same standard. I mean, whether it's a private company or whether it's Duke Energy or whether it's, you know, somebody else, you know, if there is a threat to the water supply, I'm not quite sure why there would be a different standard in the reporting process.
The only thing you can say about Duke is that when Duke had the coal ash spill, there were, you know, 38,000 tons it's not like you could have kept that a secret. I mean, this is something where, although it was a significant spill, it wasn't something nearly as visible or as obvious as a coal ash breach. So there's a bit of a difference there. And I don't.
Well, I mean, yeah, if there's contamination in the water system, there's a contamination in the water system.
And
this, on August 7th, when that sample was taken, it was like 300 times what the regular safe level was.
There are regular reports that we have leaching coming from coal ash dumps under Duke's control all over the state into water supplies. We've had cancer clusters in Lake Norman where people have believed very fervently that's the result of coal ash chemicals leaking into their water supply there. Duke has not gone out of their way to announce that. So, again, all corporations that are polluting our water ought to be held, I agree, to the same standard, but I don't think we can say that,
well, if
that there's a double standard here because of some one's got more political influence.
If we're
than
concerned
the other.
About water quality, then we ought to be concerned about water quality.
Agreed to that.
Becky Gray, Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Hey, before we let you go, a brief solicitation. Yes, asking you for money. Oh, so awkward. It is, after all, a pledge drive here at WUNC North Carolina Public Radio, during which we hear from thousands and thousands of listeners, individuals just like you who support us. And it's an odd business model, but I pledge to you that it really does work. Believe it or not, more than half of the revenue at North Carolina Public Radio comes from listeners, more than half. We actually don't get any direct state funding, and less than 10% of our budget comes from the federal government. So, if you have already supported public radio stations or a radio station like this one, thank you. Thank you very much. And if you have not, think about doing it. You can call 919-962-9862, or you can pledge online at WUNC.org. And if you're wondering, yes, I am a sustainer of WUNC. Any which way, thanks for listening and supporting public radio.